Welcome once again, everyone, to another episode of There's Just Something About Kansas City. I'm sitting here with an old friend of mine who I've known for a long, long period of time, Kurt Nelson. He is the senior director of the Royals Hall of Fame, as you might get an idea of where we're seated right now inside the Royals Hall of Fame. And welcome, Kurt.
Well, welcome to you. Yeah. Welcome into my living room here at the Royals Hall of Fame.
You know, it's this is really your baby. I mean, you're the one that I know they had the Royals Hall of Fame before 1999, okay? Mm-hmm. But it was, I think, you spearheading and doing a lot of the legwork about getting the Royals Hall of Fame, getting all of this memorabilia, and just getting this thing done. And it was it's a labor of love for you.
Oh, it definitely is. You know, the Royals Hall of Fame started in 1986, but for years we had a concourse display and things like that. And when I first came here in the marketing department in 99, that was still out there. But it was really when the renovations came to the ballpark that there was always going to be a physical place in which we were going to do that. And that's when ownership at the time came to me and said, you know, we think you might be the person for this, because I did get to I did get to be known around. It's like people would go around. Even when I first started working here in 99, people sort of asked something about Royals history or whatever. They said, go ask Kurt. He might know. And so I did get that reputation. So when they decided they were going to have a physical place, they thought that maybe I would be the person to do it. So, and it certainly has been a labor of love. I always say inside of here, everything that's true inside of here, but it is in some measure Royals history as told by Kurt Nelson. But I liked it. I lived it. I really lived it because I've been a Royals fan my entire life. And, you know, from the time I knew what baseball was and knew that I liked it, and the Royals were my team primarily for family reasons. I did not grow up in Kansas City, but it was primarily for family reasons why the Royals became my team.
Yeah, you're an Oklahoman. So yes. You're born and raised in Oklahoma. And tell me a little bit about the background of mom and dad and siblings and how this all came about with you as a big Royals fan.
Born and raised in Tulsa. So that's still, I still like to think that that's my hometown. I've been gone so
Not
long
really.
That when I go back there, I've lived in Kansas City longer than I've lived anywhere else at this point by far. But I do think of that as sort of my hometown, except when I go back there and nothing's where it's supposed to be, which you find that when you're away from your hometown for a while. But yeah, grew up in Tulsa, born and raised there. Went to the University of Oklahoma as an undergrad, so I'm a Sooner through and through, born and bred. But both of my parents were from Kansas City, and see, that's where the connection really comes. My parents were both born in Kansas City. My mom really grew up here. My dad moved to Wichita when he was in grade school, but still had family in Kansas City. And so I always had family in Kansas City. So Kansas City was my second hometown, mm-hmm. my first hometown now, my entire life, because I'd been coming here all the time to see relatives and everything. So I was familiar with the place my entire life, felt very comfortable here, felt like it was my hometown. And that's where the Royals come in, because, you know, I always joke, but there's some truth to it. You know, Mr. and Mrs. K were awarded the franchise, mm-hmm. the expansion franchise on January 11th, 1968. And I was born on February 16th, 1968. So I always tell people, if you want to know how old the Royals are, this is how
here
old
I
the
am.
Here, I'm a living example of how old the Royals are. So people always ask me also, it's like, how long have you been with the Royals? I said, well, there's two parts to that question. It's like, how long have I worked for the Royals? Which is probably what you're thinking. I've been with the Royals from the very, very beginning. So by the time, you know, you get to about 5 or 6 years old and you start getting piqued into this interest, it's like, oh, what is this? This is baseball. This is something I really like. And listening on a transistor radio, because I am that old, and just really got, and I'm very fortunate in the sense that, you know, from I was 8 years old in 1976, and you think that's the first time we you know, made the postseason.
I
was in 1985, I was a senior in high school. So you think my entire childhood, I knew nothing but winning and exciting baseball and some of the most exciting players in the game. And I'm very grateful to all those people to have grown up in this particular time frame in which mm-hmm. that is my reference point. And that got so deeply embedded in me that I'm very fortunate that it not only became something that I was passionate about, but it was something that, that became a career. It's crazy how that worked
it
out.
Is, it
it's
is like, crazy. And so what about your siblings?
Mm-hmm.
You have
I have two brothers.
Two brothers, okay.
I'm the middle child.
Right, and you're born in Oklahoma, okay, mm-hmm. and raised there. And I know you had to connect to Kansas City, but Oklahoma's football country.
Yes.
I mean, you know, so you going over to baseball, of all things, you know, although University of Oklahoma and Oklahoma State are very good at baseball as well. But that was pretty interesting. Did you have a little battle there with any of the siblings, or was everybody in the family a baseball fan?
Everybody in my family was a Royals fan. My parents, I always say, it's hard for me to figure out about my parents when I think about it now, because they've passed away now. And then when my dad passed away not too long ago, someone asked, what was he interested in? And I knew some of the things he was interested in. I mean, my dad was really interested in military history. He was in the Army as a young man. It was a really transformative experience for him. And so he was, and he grew up right in the World War II era. So he was always fascinated by that and watching war movies mm-hmm. and things like that. But I always think about their involvement in sports. It's like, I think about my dad and my mom. I don't think they were huge sports fans. They became huge sports fans because me and my two brothers, like, so I think of them as sports fans, mm-hmm. but I think about their previous life before they had the three of us. I don't think they were huge sports fans. They were supporting their three kids and their passion for sports. But yes, I have an older brother. I'm the middle child. I have an older brother that's about a little less than 2 years older than me. And then I have a younger brother who's 6 years younger than me. All involved in sports to the extent that my older brother was the best athlete. He played everything. He had a little bit of that touch gene of being able to play everything. And my younger brother played a lot of baseball. And he's still in baseball today. He's an assistant baseball coach and admissions counselor at Rockhurst University, which he's
going to... Well, it's wonderful. He's right here in town.
Yes, he's going to turn 50 years old. He left home to go to Rockhurst University after his senior year in high school. He's still there. He hasn't left yet.
Some guys never graduate.
He never left. He found a place he liked, and he's still there. But I always joke, so my older brother was a very good athlete, played baseball, football. He was a quarterback in high school and basketball. My younger brother played baseball, and he played it all the way up into college a little bit, he would say. He sort of became a coach in his sophomore year of college.
Right.
And but I always joke with both of them because I didn't really play sports. I played, you know, like two junior varsity baseball games in my entire life, and I hadn't played since I was in third grade when I did that. And but I joke with them because I'm the one that made the big leagues. So but they were a huge part of, you know, our involvement with sports, and sports is one of those wonderful things in the fact that it really still connects me. My older brother lives in St. Louis, a little patch of blue in that sea of red, and my younger brother, of course, lives here in town, and I see him physically more often, but we are connected every single day almost in today's world, primarily through texting, and our good friend that's basically our fourth brother that lives in Chicago, a constant text stream of things that are going on in sports.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that really connects us. Oklahoma football.
There you go. Nothing wrong with that.
And Chiefs and Royals, and my friend Dave, our friend Dave that lives in Chicago, of course, brings in a little bit of Bears and Cubs into the conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's probably not a White Sox fan. Nobody ever admits to being a White Sox fan.
He's a huge Cubs fan, so we sort of claim them as our National League team, But it is one of those ties that bind, mm-hmm. and I'm very thankful for it because it is one of the ways that, you know, I'm so fortunate because I have friends that I consider brothers, and my brothers I consider friends, and everybody doesn't get that.
Yeah, I'm
very fortunate.
You, after University of Oklahoma, you went to the University of Missouri to get MBA.
I think
you're working towards a probably business type deal. Tell us about the path there. Why? We'll get to Walden Books here in a minute, but the deal is, what was your thought? You leave Oklahoma, you're a big baseball fan.
Mm-hmm.
You really probably don't know you're going to get into sports administration at that point.
I was hoping.
You never know. So you're covering CYA, right? You're covering yourself. So you go back to grad school at Mizzou.
I did go to grad school at Mizzou, and what's interesting about that is my my parents, we had lived in Tulsa my entire life. And while I was at the University of Oklahoma, my dad had to change jobs and they moved to Jefferson City, Missouri. And so when I graduated from college, my mother really wanted me to go to grad school. And her thought process was, you know, if you go out and get a job, the chances that you'll go back to grad school might not be as much. Right. And she thought, you can do it. We can do this. And so she kind of wanted me to go to grad school then. And I was fine with that. But they had moved to Missouri at that time. And my mom was actually a graduate of the University of Missouri. She had gone briefly to the University of Kansas. And in my family's way
You're
of trying,
all the bases
trying to cover all of the, my maternal grandfather went to the University of Nebraska. So I think I was trying to cover all the schools of the Big Eight Conference, the old Big Eight Conference. But that's really how I ended up at the University of Missouri is, I thought about going to grad school at OU. My mother was a huge influence on me, obviously, and she thought it would be better if I went to a different school for grad school. And they had moved to Mizzou. That was also her alma mater, right. And it gave me a chance to be closer to them and everything. So that's how I ended up at Mizzou.
Right, and then you do the master's, okay? Mm-hmm. And you also did Master's of Education. And now it's with a little bit of a sports administration, you know.
That was my bent at that time. Okay.
So you're thinking down that line now.
I'm thinking I would like to be involved in sports.
Okay.
And I thought that while I was at OU, too, and I was much too shy. This is what I always tell young people when I have an opportunity to speak in front of them, because there's so many people that think they want to be involved in sports, and baseball will test you in that sense of whether you want to be involved in it, because it's but if you love it, it's fantastic. But it's a grind. It's a grind, especially on people with families and everything. But I always thought I wanted to be involved in sports, and I was much too shy when I was at OU. I worked in the sports information department for just a brief period of time, but I wasn't assertive enough to say, I'll do this. And I really missed out on a lot, because I think I could have been involved in a lot of things at the University of Oklahoma that would have been just great for me. I would have enjoyed them, but I was much too shy about it and going to a big school at the time. I went to Casha Hall High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in which my graduating class was like 30 guys.
Yeah,
it was still an all-boys school at the time. And all of a sudden, I'm in, you know, freshman classes at OU, and there's 2,000 people in the class, you know. So I think I was a little bit reticent to do that. So when I went to grad school, it was like, you know, you gotta get out there a little bit. So I got two master's degrees at the time, because I could come back and get a sports administration degree with another year of graduate school. So I got two master's degrees in the span of about 2.5 years. And while I was there, I started working in the Mizzou athletic department.
Right, you're a marketing assistant.
I was a marketing assistant there, you know, as a glorified intern. But that was really my first entree into really doing events and some marketing and things like that. And I really got in the latter part of my time there is I worked with Coach McCarter, who was the head baseball coach there at the time. They needed some help in the baseball team, and just doing simple things like making sure the press box was set up and even making hotel reservations and things like that on road trips. And so I did a little bit of that, and that was sort of seeding the clouds a little bit. It didn't lead directly to what would come, but it was certainly an important part of eventually getting a job in sports.
Right. You were there, and that's great on your resume. But then I think you leave there in 94, right, in that area. All of a sudden in 1995, you want to tell me I got the Walden Books?
Yeah. So this is how those things happen. Life happens. Life has plans for you. So how that happened was I worked at Kinko's. It's called FedEx Kinko's there. Yeah. My brother's actually made a career out of this, but... So I was working there in Jefferson City, and while I was in grad school. And then when I was in grad school, there was a couple of other interns at the University of Missouri that were involved in the restaurant business. And so we thought we'd open a sports bar, you know, great plans. And we did. I always call it my third master's, and it was by far the most expensive one. And so we did that for a couple of years. And
what was the name of the bar?
It was called Legend Sports Bar and Grill in Columbia, right there in downtown. And great learning experience, not good financially, but and then so that didn't make it. The hockey strike was really a bad part. That was right when the Blues were really good, and we got really hit hard. So that went by the wayside. And then, you know, in between time, you think to yourself, well, I gotta have a job, because in all that time I was working in the bar, I was making no money. The only time I made money was when I was bartending,
yeah,
and I would make tips, and that was the only time. God bless my dad, because I lived at his house during that time. And so that goes away, and you think, well, I got to get a job while I look for a job. And anybody who's found a job while they're looking for a job find out that that's kind of hard to do, and you start doing the job. So I got a job at the bookstore at the Columbia Mall, at the Walden Books there, and before long, I'm assistant manager there, and I'm working there, and the one in Jeff City as well, and they asked me to become a manager at their store in Carbondale, Illinois, and that's how I ended up in Carbondale, Illinois for about a year, and that's really, and this goes back to family, too, because this is really a story. My story has a lot to do with people that helped me be in the position that I'm in. I'm like a frog on a fence post, you know. How the hell did he get there? Somebody put him there.
That's exactly right. We're going to find out how you did get up there.
But so I was working in Carbondale, Illinois, and I thought to myself, it wasn't that I was unhappy, but I was like, you know, I went to school, and the whole idea was to be involved in sports. And I said, I can be the manager of a bookstore or something, and there's nothing wrong with doing that either, but I can do something like that in a place I want to be,
right,
instead of Carbondale, Illinois, where I didn't know anybody. So I thought, you know, I'd rather be in Kansas City doing that than Carbondale, Illinois. So God bless my dad. You think you have a son you helped get through school. He has two master's degrees. He did this restaurant thing, which
he can't get a job.
And he's, so I call my dad and I say, you know what, Dad, I think I'm going to quit my job.
Oh boy.
And move to Kansas City. And you think to yourself, it's like, my dad would have every reason to tell me, you are not quitting your job. Are you insane? No, you're not doing that. And God bless him. What his response was, if that's what you want to do, I think you should do it. And he goes, and I'll come help you.
Wow.
And it made all the difference, because I did move to Kansas City, and that was in like November of 98. And I tried to find a job. And I interviewed so many places in that interim period into December and January of 98, 99. And I knew people at the Royals. I didn't know them, but I knew who they were. I didn't know them, right, but I knew who everybody that worked at the Royals was. So I was looking for a job everywhere and doing interviews. I didn't get any jobs. I thought I was close to getting a job a couple of times. I always think these are unanswered prayers, right?
Oh, yeah,
something,
they are.
Something's going on, because mm-hmm. I wasn't getting a job. And then there was a posting at the Royals for this intern position. Now, mind you, I was almost 31 years old at the time. And there was this intern position, and I can still remember it because I was using the computers at Rockhurst University, because my brother, as I told you, was there. And so I applied for this internship job with the Royals in the marketing department. And I got a call back the next day. I got a call. I sent that on a Thursday, fax machine back then. And I got a call on Friday saying, can you come in and interview on Monday? And that was the longest weekend of my life. And I came in on Monday, and I interviewed for that job, and I tried to sell myself the best I could. You know, it's like
you sold your soul is what you did, right?
I understand all the limitations of the job, because it paid minimum wage, whatever it was then, $6 an hour or whatever.
They're probably all kids.
They were. I was 10 years older almost than any of the other people. And already had two master's degrees, and the job began in March and ended in, you know, in August or early September, and I went in there and explained, you know, I understand all the limitations of this job or whatever, but I want you to know I want this job. And I got a call back, and I got the job. And that changed everything, because everything just sort of rolled from there. whatever led me there and all the people that led me there and everything. I did apply myself. I think I, you know, was the reason that I was able to stay here was that, but it wasn't too long after that. There was another break in the fact that an administrative assistant in Patty Bowen, God bless her, a wonderful person, but she had decided she was going to take another job. I always remember is I worked for the director of marketing and the director of group sales at the time. And I was booking national anthems and doing triplicate forms on group sales way back in 1999 and working on those. And but we worked a lot of hours right before opening day that year. And then it was supposed to calm down. So I remember them coming to me. It's like, we got to cut back the hours a little bit. You know, the season started, you know, beforehand. Right. And then Patty left. And I came in the next day and they said, here, sit at this desk here. And I, all intents and purposes, became a full-time employee about 3 or 4 weeks into that. And here I am 25 years later.
Yeah, the amazing thing, and this, you know, hope young people or their parents or whatever, when they listen to this, understand, don't stop chasing your dreams. You never stop chasing your dream through that whole period of time. You had tremendous support, and you know your dad, God bless him, as you say, you know, said, go ahead and chase your dreams. And said, you know, you've got this job. You know, you'll end up being Walden, you know, superstar or something for Walden Books, but you just did never stop chasing your dream, which I think is a lesson for everybody to learn, especially a young person, that don't ever give up on those dreams.
It's important, and you never know where the break's going to come.
Right.
You know, you never know where the right breaks are. I always tell you, treat people kindly because you never know. You never know who the person is that's gonna be your conduit into getting something that's really exciting. So
this flashed in my mind too. You took over what Rush Limbaugh used to do for the Royals, right?
He did. He had. Yeah. He had. Me and him couldn't be more different. But but yes.
What he, you want to talk politics? No.
I'm only kidding.
No. That's a joke. God bless his soul.
But it would show how baseball can be a uniter. It's because he had certainly a passion for Royals baseball. He came about it from a different way. But yes, in many ways, my first internship job here was very similar to some of the things that he did during his time with the Royals, booking anthems and first pitches.
Right, that's what he did. Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. Yeah. So yes, in some ways we stepped in each other's footsteps there.
Yeah, right. So now all of a sudden you have a full-time job in exactly what you want to do. Just take us through to this.
Yes.
Situation right here.
That was in marketing, and that's really what I went to school. I thought that was going to be the way I could get involved in sports, get involved on the marketing side of sports, the business side of sports. And it was the way that I got involved in sports. And I will say, despite the fact that they were separated by a couple of years, that my resume at the time, that those 3 years that I spent at Mizzou in which I was working in the athletic department really came through, because even on that, you know, I go back to talk to Tanya and Michelle, the two people that hired me. It's like they said one of the things that stood out about that was, you know, always looking for that sort of experience that's sort of transferable. And so that was important, and that did get me the job. So I started out when I was doing stuff like that, and I had the longest title was the first one I ever had. It was like group sales and pregame assistant or something, you know, it was some big old longer title that really meant not very much, but I worked my way up in marketing. So I worked from there, became, you know, marketing assistant to marketing coordinator to, by the time I was finished, I spent the first 10 years with the Royals in the marketing department, which I was director of marketing when I first took on the role of the Hall of Fame back in 2008-ish. When the renovation process, and like I was saying before, I did get sort of the reputation as the person that knew a little bit too much about Royals history and some geeky stuff or whatever. So they thought that I would probably be a person that might serve in this particular role, which didn't exist before. So it's so sui generis in that way. It's like I made it up as I went. They gave me the keys, and I sort of made it up as I went along.
And you know everything about Royals history. You obviously have delved into everything. We'll talk about, you know, the ESPN 30 for 30s on Bo Jackson, and we can talk about all this stuff. I walked in, as soon as you walk into the Hall of Fame down here, you see the streetcar, an old municipal stadium, the old stadium back in the A's days, and then the early Royals days before they came over here to the K. But you go all the way back there, you go all the way back to Jackie Robinson and the Kansas City Monarchs and the history of baseball in this town. And I think you thought it was extremely important that this be here.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite parts of this is obviously I'm steeped in Royals history. It's my lived history. So I knew I've learned more about it, but I already had came at it with a huge foundation of Royals history and the great things in Royals history and how much there's just so much. It's so layered and everything, as every franchise I'm sure is. But I also wanted to share the story of how important baseball is to Kansas City and how important Kansas City is to baseball. The same, it's a two-way street. I always point out is the first major league team we had in Kansas City was a team in the Union Association way back in 1884. I was like, it's for a town, especially this far, and it's like it was primarily in the, coming out of the Civil War was an interesting time for baseball history because that's really how the game sort of spread a little bit. It's interesting how the Civil War sort of spread baseball because it was really kind of a New York, New England game. And then it gets spread because of all the soldiers that are going out on both the North and South side, especially for prisoner of war camps.
Yeah, they're playing baseball in camp.
They're playing baseball.
Mm-hmm. And they're in their POW camp.
It's really how the game gets this spread. And then coming out of that, they had all had this experience and it really starts spreading out. So you think about how important that is. And there was an amateur team in our particular area called the Antelopes that springs up right after the Civil War. And they had their rival, the Atchison Pomeroys, and there's, battles between those two. But 1884, first major league, a major league team, not just a professional. Our first professional team was a major league team. And the city didn't even become Kansas City until 1889.
Wow.
So I would say Major League Baseball has been in our town since before we called ourselves Kansas City. That's how deeply embedded baseball is in Kansas City. And since then, since 1884, there's only been one year in which we didn't have at least one hometown team, and that's 1968. That's the only year. And a lot of times we had more than one. There were different times where we had two and sometimes three teams in this town. So baseball's been important in this town from the very beginning. And then, baseball, there's the fabric of the town. I think it's so important to be able to tell those stories. And it's a fun story to tell because there's so many colorful characters and memorable moments that happen even in these years where most of us don't really, delve that much into it. But if you're involved, if you appreciate baseball and you appreciate history and all those sorts of things, it's endlessly fascinating to go back and think about all these people that came through here. We have the Cooperstown Connection wall in here in which it's I forget what the numbers are now because there's even a few more, but it's like almost 16-17% of all the people that are in the National Baseball Hall of Fame at some point in their baseball career have a connection to Kansas City.
That's incredible.
It's really an important part of the fabric of the town. And so yes, when given the opportunity to share that story, it's not only the Royals history is built off this huge foundation that goes back generations way before then. It's one of the reasons that we've been a successful franchise is the idea that we're built on this solid rock of foundation of a baseball town with baseball history.
Right, and ownership too.
Especially,
after Charlie O. Lees, you talk about colorful characters.
Yes.
Charlie O. Finley was here with the old Kansas City A's that eventually became the Oakland A's. But he was quite the character, and that was the year we lost baseball, was the one year when he picks up and leaves, and we had to go back and do a lot of marketing to Major League Baseball in order for Muriel and Ewing Kauffman to bring baseball back.
We had some very important people that loved baseball. See, so it goes into this fabric of there were a lot, if you know the history of that time, you know that Finley was really trying to get out of Kansas City for a long time, always looking for greener pastures, and also got sideways with a lot of people in Kansas City, the powers that be, which is not really a, so there was very antagonistic.
It's not conducive.
No, it's not. And you know, what's when I go back to the Finley history, it's always interesting to me is the A's did move, the Athletics moved from Philadelphia to here. It's mm-hmm. always, it's the first westward migration of Major League Baseball. I always want to tell the Kansas City portion of baseball history. It's so much of the westward movement of Major League Baseball is tied to the Dodgers and Giants mm-hmm. leaving New York and going west. But 2 years before that happened, the A's moved from east to Kansas City, which is the furthest team west at the time. So it really, it sort of predates the westward. It's the first real westward movement of right. Major League Baseball is not really Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's Kansas City
right.
when the A's move here. And then, of course, they would move to Oakland. And then if they're might be moving again, but they're moving east this time. They kept moving west, but if they yeah. moved west again, they would end up in the middle of the ocean.
They'd be out in Catalina Islands.
So they're moving.
The coast.
They're moving east again. But so I always think about that particular time is there were a lot of people in Kansas City that were anticipating that move, and they knew it was coming. So they did have the where they already put together an action plan. It's like, hey, this is going to happen eventually. Eventually, the owners are going to allow him to move the team. And it was at the same owners' meetings in Chicago when in November of 67, when the American League owners approved the move of the A's from Kansas City to Oakland. There was a Kansas City delegation there already making the case, we deserve an expansion
Another
franchise.
Team, yeah.
We deserve an expansion franchise. And they used every bit of leverage they possibly could. They got before that meeting, they had gone to some people in town and said, hey, we're going to go to the American League owners and the A's are going to eventually move and we need to be able to go to the owners and say there's somebody in Kansas City that has the financial wherewithal and the interest to do it. So they had gone to Ewing Kauffman and said, can we just take a line of credit that of $1 million and just use your name as someone who might be interested in a major league team? And he said yes. And he wasn't a huge baseball fan per se, but he was a huge fan of Kansas City and was convinced that baseball was important to Kansas City. So he said, yes, of course, please do that. So they did that, and they received a promise of an expansion team. Now, they didn't say when. That was always the problem at that particular meeting, and that's when those powers that be used the power of Stuart Symington, who was a Democratic senator from the state. I always say there's two senators. If we want to get into politics, there's two senators that have played an important role in Royals history. One, and I'll be bipartisan here because it is bipartisan, one, Democrat Stuart Symington from Missouri, and Republican Bob Dole from Kansas in a much mm-hmm. later iteration of the Royals. He plays an important role in the transition of the Royals after Mr. K with the plan in which the Royals' monies would be given to charity
right.
as we were waiting for an owner. So they both played a very important role in Royals history. But Symington went to the owners at that time and brought up, you know, this might cause you a little bit of problems. We need more. It's because if you think about it, in June of 1967 is when the bond issue was passed to build what we would later know as the Truman Sports Complex. I didn't know it at the time. That happened while the A's were still playing here. So the case was, hey, we're building this new ballpark. We can't build a new ballpark and just have it sit there empty. We need to know when a team is going to come
right.
here. So they were able to, on the same day, they called a meeting at like midnight in which they barely had a quorum because some of the other owners had left and gave a more firm date of 1969.
Wow.
So they had said it was going to be maybe 1971 when we get to it. But same day, they got a guarantee of 1969.
That's pressure.
And that's really, that's the Royals. It ends up being the Royals. And so they came back and they had secured this team, and then they were going to throw it open. Okay, now let's look for an owner. And that's the beautiful thing about Mr. Kauffman is, you know, they had used his name, and he had agreed to use the name. He hadn't agreed to purchase the team or anything like that, and he had to go through the ownership. But he goes, I thought the team was mine at that time. So he goes, my salesmanship sort of came up in me. And that's really when he sort of really got involved and went through all the process of learning about what baseball would be mm-hmm. and how he would be involved in it. And Mrs. K, of course, played a huge role.
I was going to say, Mrs. K was always right behind him going, we're going to do this, we're going to do this.
Huge role in that.
Yeah.
And so that's really the birth yeah. of the Royals. And it's really a community effort. I always say the Royals, the, coming out of the A's experience was, the A's moving back got a team, a major league team back in Kansas City, but the Royals were really the first time that they had a chance to build Kansas City's major league
yeah,
team,
sure.
which is a different thing altogether. It always felt a little transitory, and whereas the Royals felt like this was an opportunity to build a team that was of Kansas City, and that, you know, Mr. K was the owner, and the name came from fans and has a distinct tie to Kansas City with the American Royal, which is where the Royal name comes from.
Right.
And the logo was designed by Shannon Manning at Hallmark.
Talk about the logo, which he never got a dime for.
He did right? not get a dime for it. You know,
the Hallmark, I guess they went to Hallmark and say they went to all their graphic artists or whatever they were.
They did.
Right?
It was sort of a contest between the graphic artist at Hallmark. So they wanted professionals to do this part, and they threw it open. And Shannon Manning, who's such a wonderful gentleman, we just lost him a couple of years ago, and I got an opportunity to meet him, and you mm-hmm. couldn't meet a nicer gentleman. But he had just moved to Kansas City recently in that particular time frame from Chicago, and he was a graphic designer at Hallmark, and he, along with other graphic designers, submitted these different ideas for, and some of them were, you know, on a sort of a lark and ironic, you know, a big cow and things like
yeah.
this. And, but, you know, he took it very seriously and came up with, I'm completely biased, but, you know, there it is right there, came up with this timeless beauty in my humble opinion. And he always used to talk about the original one, for those that are a little bit older will remember, it had an R with a white R in the center of the shield
right.
with a gold KC. And he always talked about how they always wanted him to put something in the loop of the R. And he always tried to dissuade them.
Yeah, they're trying to put
that.
A cow in there horse.
If you try to stuff something in there, when it gets down small, nobody's going to be able to tell what it is. And
right.
you should leave it clean, because it's really clean without it. Thankfully, they listened to it. But he kept submitting this designs, of which we have a few of them in the final design that he gave to us and is on display in the Royals Hall of Fame. But so it's sort of a community effort. And he did receive season tickets that year for that.
That year.
But he always took great pride in the idea that logo was still around and people were wearing it. He especially mm-hmm. enjoyed the fact that young people, when he would see young people wearing that logo and know that that was really something. And this is special about Kansas City, is he had just moved to Kansas City, but he lived the rest of his life here as people that move to Kansas City will often
have a tendency to do, yes. That's why we do this. There is just something about Kansas City.
There's something about Kansas City.
Right.
I always say the special uniqueness about Kansas City is so many places is they want you to be from there. It's like being from there is important. Whereas I say in Kansas City, once again, I'm biased, but I believe it to be true, is in Kansas City, it's not important that you're from here. But it's important that you're of Kansas City.
Yeah, right.
See, once you're here, it's like they're interested in where you came from, and they don't, you know, there's not a barrier based on where you come from, but they appreciate the fact that you've come to Kansas City and then you become immersed in Kansas City. That's the important part, is to be of Kansas
right.
City, not necessarily from Kansas City.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. It's just been incredible. And what you've done here is incredible. And I know it started out not like this, not having its own area here, and to let fans, sometimes I think there's fans out there don't even realize, game day, if you're here, it's open, it's free, you don't have to pay anything extra, whatever, you can come early to the game, and tailgate a little bit, and then come in early when the gate's open, and come on down here and check it out, and please, it's just, the history here is phenomenal. I mean, it's just, there's things here that I look at and I go, geez, I didn't know that, and then I go, I didn't know that either, you know? I'm going to give you we're going to do some word association here, okay?
Sure.
So just with people and with things that have been associated with the Kansas City Royals. First thing will be the Baseball Academy, Royals Baseball mm-hmm. Academy. Your thoughts on the idea was, I think, fantastic. Ended up getting two professional players who went through here, and of course one was Frank White and the other was UL Washington. They came through here and ended up making the Major League Baseball team. So talk to me a little bit about the academy.
It's really, you know, Mr. K is an innovative thinker, right? And a very competitive person. So he thought to himself, it's like, what is a way, and you got to remind yourself, this is before the era of free agency, just briefly before that, but it's before free agency, and the only way of acquiring talent is through the draft. The draft was in effect, it started in 65, so the draft was in effect, and it's like drafting and trading were really and signing amateur free agents, which we did some of that too, that would make the big leagues, but amateur free agents is all the academy guys were free agents, non-drafted players. Right. And the idea is you didn't necessarily have to be a baseball player, you know, to become a baseball player. There were athletic skills. It was more like an idea of what are the traits of a baseball player that you could find in other athletes. And
this was using analytics before analytics.
It really is. It really is using that. And it was really forward thinking in the way that they used video and things like that, and stopwatches, which sounds ridiculous, but stopwatches and different ways of measuring people. And eyesight was really important. And they went to an eye specialist and came up with this tool that even a scout could use. It didn't need to be a doctor, that could test people's depth perception and thing like this. So they would go out and they would do all this, and they literally went coast to coast, all the way up into Canada. I have Sid Thrift, who was the director of the academy, and I still have some of his letters and all these tryout camps, so literally from coast to coast and whatever, and they did. And they found these different athletes. Some of them were baseball players, but some of them weren't. And the idea was you could send them to an intensified instruction academy.
Learn the game.
And you would learn, it would be like day and night. It's like everything you would do would be revolve around learning the aspects of baseball. Now, they also went to Manatee Junior College because Mr. K believed that baseball wasn't everything, so they needed to take some of the most important courses that they made them take at Manatee Junior College was finance and public speaking, which would be important. And
wow.
So they did that, but it's like this intensified instruction. And it worked to the extent that there were several players that did reach the big leagues. I always find it interesting, the two that you mentioned were our double play combination,
yes,
our first pennant-winning team, are both non-drafted free agents that come through the Royals Baseball Academy.
Which is incredible, yeah.
Some people say that, you know, the academy wasn't around very long and it didn't produce very much, but if you had a draft in which you produced a double play combination, you would consider that a good draft. So, and what's interesting about those two is, I say we literally went coast to coast, and that is true, but some of the best that we found is like Frank was like three blocks away from the ballpark, and UL was from Stringtown, Oklahoma, and came up to a tryout camp in Kansas City,
yeah,
because he had a family member who was working as an usher at Municipal Stadium who said, you should come out and go to one of these tryout camps.
Wow.
And that's really how that happened. But yes, it was very innovative. It worked. And
what happened?
Well, what happened was Mr. K always explained.
It only lasted 2 years, right?
It lasted about 3.5. It sort of got melded into the minor leagues after a
All
while.
Right.
Mr. K always explained that, one, he always said it was his biggest regret in baseball was shutting down the academy. And his reasoning for it was that we were supposed to move into this ballpark in 1972, and there were a myriad of issues that required us. In fact, at the end of the 1971 season, they had the last game of 71 season, they dug up home plate at Municipal Stadium. We were going to the new ballpark, but ended up back at
Municipal
Stadium that year. And he said that there were some financial reasons why. And that was sort of the impetus for him shutting down the baseball academy, along with some, you know, it was always a little bit of a contentious issue,
yeah,
inside the Royals, because there were traditional baseball people and academy people, and there was always a little bit of tension there. Probably good tension when you think about it, but tension nonetheless. So that's really when the academy, so it didn't appear as if it was bearing any fruit, but it actually did later on. Yeah. And what's interesting about it is not only, if you think about it more deeply, it did produce some important players, and Ron Washington, who's the managing in the big leagues again for the Angels, but mm-hmm. won two pennants with the managing the Rangers. He's a Baseball Academy graduate. And I always point out that there were other coaches. There's a lot of coaches that came out of the Baseball yeah. Academy. They were players into the Baseball Academy, but they were so intensified in the instruction that they became very good teachers of sure. the game. And Hal Baird being one of them, who would go on and become a great SEC baseball coach
at
Auburn mm-hmm. University. And that's sort of our initial tie to Bo Jackson, too. So there's a Royals tie there. But it really had an impact not only for the players that came up, but for coaches, and was a sort of a gift to baseball, because a lot of the ideas of what an intensified instruction academy is are still in place. Almost every single team has one somewhere, mm-hmm. usually in Latin America now. And there's a lot of the aspects of the Royals Baseball Academy that are in those. I don't think you could do it necessarily anymore,
right.
because the scouting is so deep inside especially the United States. I don't know that you would find the gems that you would have found then. But
yeah.
yes, it's a very interesting part of Royals history.
Yeah, and you brought up the name Bo Jackson, of course, probably one of the greatest athletes ever. He's the greatest athlete I think I ever covered, okay? I'm not sure if Jim Brown wasn't maybe the greatest athlete I've ever seen, but Bo, I got to see him when I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, and we used to go to the Steelers games. Back in those days, Steelers were awful. Cleveland Browns would come to town in the 50s and early 60s, and there was this guy. My dad would always take us up to go watch this guy named Jim Brown, and just he was a man among boys. He was what would be an offensive tackle today playing in the backfield.
Yes.
He was Derrick Henry before Derrick
yes.
Henry. Okay, but we're not talking about that. But you've done a 30 for 30 with Bo. You were very mm-hmm. instrumental in that. Bo will be inducted into this Hall of Fame in 2024. One of the greatest athletes, like we said, maybe not the greatest baseball player ever or the greatest football player, but he certainly crossed both and was terrific at both. Word association, your thoughts about Bo Jackson.
Bo Jackson is, I always describe him as like a superhero come to life, you know? Because you hear what sound like apocryphal stories, but with Bo, you kind of believe that they might be true, you know? He scaled a wall in Baltimore as if he was Spider-Man, and you would go, that's not true, but it's like, well, look at this video.
Yeah.
And did these superhuman things, and what I always think about him is the whole backstory of how he became a Royal is fascinating in and of itself. But when he came to the big leagues, he was this incredible mix of speed and power. Something that, in a way that I don't even think most people who did not get the privilege of seeing him play at the height of his skill, I don't think they can fully apprehend what was going on. But I got to see him play in the minor leagues. That's how involved me and my brothers were and my family is. We went to Memphis and saw him play in a minor league game. So he didn't play very many minor league games, but we saw him play a minor league game. And but when he got to the big leagues, his very first game in the big leagues here in this ballpark, and the Royals were playing the Twins, and he comes up to bat against a future Hall of Famer at the end of his career. Steve Carlton was pitching that night. And his first at bat, he hits this mammoth shot down the left field line, and it just goes foul. And everybody oohs and ahs. It's like, oh my gosh, did you see that? But it just goes foul. So it was almost a home run in his very first at bat. And then a couple of pitches later, he hits this routine sort of hopper to second base, beat it out. And so you're thinking, what in the world is this? You know, he hits one that looks like it's going to fly up
into Nebraska.
and it goes foul. And then, you know, two pitches later, it's a ground ball to second that would normally be an out. And he beats this out as this big, huge person that he was, his thunder and lightning. It was right. It's all encapsulated in his very first at bat about what was coming. And so that's what I think about is like this superhero come to life. And it didn't last very long, unfortunately, as it's sort of an Icarus story. But man, when it was going on, it was something else. And it was like a multimedia sensation before we knew what multimedia was. And the idea that this, you know, it's Pat Mahomes is a little bit different, but it's in the realm of how ubiquitous he is known. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, George was known around the country too, and a very accomplished and for a period considered the best baseball player around. Lynn Dawson was certainly considered one of the best quarterbacks playing in the height of his career, so would have been known around the country. But it's like people not even involved in sports know who Pat Mahomes is, and people not really involved in sports during that particular time period would have definitely known who Bo Jackson. He was a cultural sensation. So. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think about him, is this larger-than-life figure.
I can remember him coming as a Raider, then all of a sudden now he's a Royal, and everybody loves him. Now all of a sudden he's a Raider. You know, he's playing
our
next
door.
Our love had
to be conditional.
Right, exactly. And the players, you know, George, everybody would be down on the sidelines when Bo came, and all of a sudden all the fans see the Royals are down. Are they cheering for Bo for the Raiders? You know, which they really were. They were cheering for Bo the man because they loved him, but they weren't really cheering
for
the Raiders.
It was a little bit of a double hit, right?
It was, right, exactly.
It was like, oh, he's going to play football. Well, who's he going to play football
for?
He
played for the Chiefs.
The Raiders.
Yeah, I know. Why did he just go across the street to the Chiefs?
So we had unconditional love for him, and then we had to have conditional love for him.
Thoughts on George Brett?
Oh, my gosh.
Number
five. George, number five.
Number five.
Right.
By the way, there's 3,154 baseballs there.
Yes.
As they indicate,
455.
How many
because
hits
that,
you know,
that
the
ball
there,
you
yeah.
see there is the 3,000th hit.
Yeah, there that it is, right there.
That is
I
the
was
3,000th
there that
hit.
Day in Anaheim. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, George is like for me that like I've got to know George in the sense that you know we're not best friends or whatever, but he's been so wonderful to me in my time here and. And so I know, it's an interesting dynamic because there's still the George Brett that is the guy that played in my childhood. Mm-hmm. And in some ways for me is like a mythical creature. And then there's the George that I know now. And so there's two different aspects of it. But I always, all the guys on the 1980 team are very special to me in the fact that that's like the crucible season for me as a 12-year-old. Of course, it was a great season, and that's one of the reasons why. And it was George's, you know, magnum opus was that 1980 season, although the 85 season of his was very,
not bad,
very underrated. His 79 season was one of the greatest of all time, too. But his 1980 season and chasing 400 and being a national figure and being the team that I follow and all that sort of stuff. So he's such a foundational presence in for me as a personal part is like he was the key cog in those teams that meant so much much to me and made my love for the Royals and what would be this career. And you know, he just did such amazing things. It's interesting when you chop up someone's Hall of Fame career, it's like it turns out that everything they do is Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. I did this because Fred White used to always do this wonderful, because unfortunately George did get hurt a lot. And a lot of that was because he played with
hard.
A very breakneck pace, you know. He didn't take plays off, and he was a hustler and all that sort of thing. So it leads to injury, but I believe George was on, I think he was on the disabled list nine times.
He missed the equivalent of one season, right?
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely one, and probably one plus.
Imagine how many hits he would have had at that point, but
so,
it happens.
And Fred used to say that George would come back from these injuries and he'd come off the DL, and Whitey used to say this too. Whitey would say, you know, George could wake up on Christmas morning and come out and, you know, put hard lick on a baseball, you know. It's like, and so I thought to myself, all these times that George would come back from injury, it's like, did he really come back? Was he like on fire from the very beginning? So I looked back and I charted it. And every single, I think it's nine, every single time, the first game back from the disabled list, every single time, he got at least one hit. So if George went on the disabled list now, or the injured list as we call it now, and came off, you could rest assured that he's going to extend that to a 10-game hitting streak in that. So yeah, it was right. True in the sense of he always did that. And he had a flair for the dramatic, right? And that's always important. And he was given opportunity. George will say this too, as a lot of people say, you always came up, you know, came through in the clutch. And he would always say, in some ways, there's two parts of that. Is one is he was given an opportunity to come in the clutch mm-hmm. because he and the teammates that he had were putting him and those teams in moments in which you would think of as clutch. And he would also say, because I had been in so many of them, it's so you remember the ones that I came through. I didn't come through in all of them necessarily, but I came through enough and I was comfortable enough in those moments because I had been given the platform mm-hmm. so many times that I was yeah. comfortable in that moment and I wanted the moment. And so you think of all those moments in which he came through. I mean, two of the obvious ones are his home run against Goose Gossaging, game three of the 1980 American League Championship Series, in which largely won the pennant for us, although there was a real hairy moment after that, and which Dan Quisenberry did a magic act and got us out of that. But that's like a seminal moment in Royals history. As yeah. I would still put it, you know, Alex Gordon has a home run that you could say is as big, and by saying it's as big is really saying something, because to have a moment that's as big as George's home run mm-hmm. against Gossage, I mean, that's pretty special. So those two home runs. And then the other one is, it happens in game three both times. Game three in the 1980 American League Championship Series, which is his virtuoso performance.
Exactly, yeah.
When he hits the two home runs and has four hits and scores the winning run and has the huge play at third base. That's important in that game. He almost, you could make a case for a position player to win a game on his own. It's really hard to do in baseball, but that is one in which you could say that he basically won that game. And there's so many delicious moments from that particular performance, because that was the first year in which the playoffs were best of seven. The championship series was best of seven. So right. We were already down 0-2. If we mm-hmm. lose that game, we'd have been down 0-3, and we probably, despite the fact that it was four games at that time, we probably don't come back. And the other thing that's special about that game is it's a real baseball moment in the sense that if Dick Houser, who was the manager of that team, Dick Houser was the manager of the 1980 New York Yankees that the Royals beat. And we beat them in three straight games. And that was his first full year as a manager. So he was 0-3 in the playoffs. Then he gets fired from the Yankees for part of what happened in the 80. Well, that's another story. But then he comes to the Royals midway through the 81, the latter part of the 81 season. We make that weird playoff at the end of the 81 season. We play the A's in a divisional playoff series, and we lost three straight games. He's 0-6 as a playoff manager. And then we surprisingly win the American League West in 1984, this precursor of the 85 team with a bunch of young pitchers and everything, and play the juggernaut Detroit Tigers.
Yeah, they were great.
And those were three really tight games. The second one was the first playoff game I was ever at, and we lost in extra innings. And then we lost 1-0 in game three. It's the toughest you could play and still get swept in a series. They were really tight games, but we lost three straight games. So now he's 0-9 in the postseason. And then we make the postseason again in 85 against the Blue Jays. We lose the first two games in Toronto. Dick Houser is 0-11 as a postseason manager. So if you see the last play of the game three of the ALCS, George catches a foul ball, which, of course, George should make the last out in that game mm-hmm. because it was such an important. Watch him come through the lawn, the congratulation, like as he's holding the ball. And as Dick Houser comes right up to him, he flashes that baseball right in his face and he puts it in his chest. He goes, "Here it is. We finally got one for you." And he gives him the ball. It's a really delicious moment, especially because you know what's coming. Now you know what's coming after that.
Right,
and
exactly.
The fact that that's going to be the moment that springs us to winning the World Series. And of course, you know, that would be, unfortunately, for health reasons, would be sort of, you know, Dick would get diagnosed with cancer the following year. So we know that, we know what the story is. So looking back at that, it's such a sweet and bitter moment at the same time.
George always had a, he always had a penchant for that. Anyway, he knew. He knows the history. He knows what's going on. Baseball was his life, obviously. Can you imagine if before Charlie Lau got a hold of him, they had this young kid named George Brett that just didn't look like he'd be able to hit Major League pitching. Can you imagine if George Brett had not had Charlie Lau and then just been sort of gone?
Isn't it? It's that goes back to that whole thing, is you don't know who that person or moment's going to be in your life that's going to flip something. What's interesting about George is George, of course, George is left-handed and I'm right-handed, so I always feel weird doing it left-handed. But if you see George early in his career, especially if you see his very first baseball card, you'll see he's got his hands way up here, like Carl Yastrzemski, who was one of his favorite players.
This is his idol.
And we came across, years later, there was this really grainy film footage of shot at spring training, and it's clearly down at Fort Myers, a place that I was familiar with because my grandfather took me there. I was very familiar. We were looking at it one time, just combing through, and I remember Chris DeReicher was here at that time, and he was showing me these film, and we didn't know what was there, so we're watching it, and I said, hold it right there, hold it, because I said, I think that's George Brett. And this would have been way before, it's probably 1971, so he was a minor league player sort of in camp. I said, I think that's George. So I look up, and George is at the plate, and he's way up here. He's way up here. And then, as luck would have it, he comes back towards the camera, and he comes right in the camera. And he almost looks right in the camera, and it's like, it's George Brett. Now, that video you can see over here, but for someone steeped in Royals history, it is interesting. You'll see him in that at-bat in Fort Myers. He's way up here. It's not the beautiful swing that we know.
It's laid back.
Happened later. And that all happened in the big leagues, too, which is interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. He was just incredible. Some other things. One of the most obscure stories about the hall that people might not know. You bring classes through here all the time. Young kids come through and you bring them, try helping them become Royals fans or whatever, but they learn their history. What is one of the most obscure things here? People just go, you're kidding me.
Oh, well, I always like those stories. So this is one that I like anyway, and there's so many of them, but this is one of my favorites. So the very first game in Royals history, April 8, 1969 at Municipal Stadium. And there's so many interesting things that happened in that game. First of all, we win in extra innings, 4-3, against who would eventually be the first. That was the first year of divisional play. The expansions brought on divisional play. So if you like expansion and divisional play and more postseason playoffs, you can give credit to Kansas City because we're the ones that started it. Or if you don't like it, you can put the blame on us, I suppose. But and that particular team would go on and win the American League West that year and had Harmon Killebrew on it and Rod Carew and a whole bunch of other really interesting players. But it was also managed by a guy named Billy Martin in his very first game as a big league manager, managing the Minnesota Twins. And of course, every first in Royals history happens in that game. Lou Piniella, who had just come to the Royals the week before, he was not in spring training with us, really. He was a great Cedric Tallis trade right at the end of spring. He had been taken in the expansion draft by the Seattle Pilots, who were our sibling American League expansion franchise, who only spent that 1 year in Seattle and then moved to Milwaukee and became the Brewers and are no longer in the American League. But so he was the first batter in Royals history, Lou Piniella. And as Lou would do, as Lou is not a patient man, so the very first pitch to Lou Piniella, he smacks for a double right down the third base line. The very first pitch a Royals player ever saw was hit for a double. So, and he scored the first run. Lou is the man of many firsts. But the other thing that's a first in that particular game that has a tie to later Royals history is the umpire. There was an umpire that was umpiring his very first big league game. And that umpire's name is, I'll bet you can guess, is Don Dinkinger's very first game as a major league umpire was the very first game in Royals history, the most favorite umpire of all time. Yes. Now, those get into fighting words for me because while that call was very influential in that game.
Talking about the Cardinals now.
As our friends on the other side of the state of Missouri have convinced themselves and certainly convinced succeeding generations that if Don Dinkinger makes the right call, which George Orta was clearly out, but if he makes the right call that the Cardinals win the World Series, which isn't true because that was he was the first batter of the inning. And when the winning run scored, there was only one out. And where was that? Who was that out? George Orta at third base. George Orta was actually eventually thrown out at third base. And I also, this is getting off on my tangent on that particular story, but people always talk about, well, if there were to be instant replay today, George Orta would be called out. That is true. But had there been instant replay now, in the sixth inning of that game, I think it was either the fifth or the sixth, Frank White stole second base and was called out. But he was safe.
He was safe, yeah.
And Pat Sheridan followed with a single, which had hit, if Frank had been called safe, with instant replay, Sheridan would have scored, mm-hmm. and the game would have been tied in the ninth inning. But people in St. Louis don't remember that.
No, they only remember one thing, and I understand why. Okay, because if it happened here, we'd be remembering
the only thing too.
As well. Maybe the one thing you don't have here you'd love to have here.
Oh, gosh.
Just give me one. I know you probably have 50.
There's so many things from the very beginning. I'm always fascinated by origins, the origin story. Yeah. So to have the first, I was talking about Lou Piniella's first hit. If we had that very first hit or the last out baseball from the very first game that was a win. One of my holy grails, and if anybody out there has one, I've always looked for it and I've never been able to find one. I would just be overjoyed if I could find a ticket from game one.
Oh,
I'm surprised there. I've never been able to find one
because it's probably sold out. How many?
It actually wasn't sold out.
How many were there? Do we have a?
It was probably about 17,000.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah. It was a very cold day and it had rained earlier in that day, which might have held down the crowd. But that's if you have a ticket from game one in Royals history, I would love to have it.
I hear they have names for the 85 World Series trophy and the 2015 World Series trophy. You want to explain that one a little bit?
Yeah.
Name in 85 is?
That one is sort of retroactive in that we named it Muriel. And obviously that comes from Mrs. K. We started calling, and it was one of the, a person that worked here at the time is... We went around. We were traveling around so much with the 2015 World Series trophy that we started talking of it as if it was an animate being, and someone said, "Well, we should name it." And it's like, "What should we name it?" And someone said, "Why don't we name it after Mrs. Glass, whose name is Ruth?" And I said, "You know, that's a good idea because my maternal grandmother, who was." Spent almost her entire adult life in Kansas City, was named Ruth. And so I'll be able to remember that. So we started calling that one Ruth. So that's when we sort of retroactively went back and named the 85 World Series trophy Muriel.
Oh, yeah. Or Babe.
We could have called it Babe.
You could have called it Babe.
But we went with Muriel.
Muriel and Ruth.
She was such an important part of Royals history.
Yeah, everybody will think.
The Royals first lady.
Yeah, everybody will think the 2015 is named after Babe Ruth.
Yes.
Obscure reason. I'm going to just hit two more things that have had you for a long period of time. It's been absolutely fascinating for me. World Series 1985, the stolen flag.
Oh, yeah.
At the 1985 World Series. Explain that story real quick.
So there's two stolen flags that I find interesting in Royals history, and we got them both back. We didn't even know we were missing them, but we got them both back. So one is the bunting, and I think that's the 85 one is tied to the bunting, and the bunting is that red, white, and blue sort of panels. And the ones that we had at the time had this blue panel in the center that had... it had an American eagle on it, and it had the red, white, and blue
on the
side.
You see them at the World Series all the time.
Yeah, you still see them. Well, we usually have them on opening day, but this was sort of an original piece of that. And someone copped to when the 14 and 15, they copped to stealing a piece of that after the 85 World Series, because it was up and around the ballpark, right, or whatever, and they said they took this stuff down. And years later, they decided that that it should come home and be here in Kansas City. So we did get that piece back, and I'm really grateful that we've. The other one that's fascinating to me, and this one is framed down in my office, although it's not hung at the moment. It used to be hung up here with our 1980 American League Championship exhibit, but we won another American League Championship in 14, so we had to make space to tell that story. But it is a 1980 American League Champions flag that never flew here at the ballpark. It's a different design than the ones that flew here at the ballpark. This one is blue with sort of white 1980 American League Champions. And what it was it was flown at Mr. and Mrs. K's house.
Oh, wow.
And this was a much more interesting, it was more clandestine delivery back to us. And this happened back in the, it would have been back in the early 2000s, is the we had a, down at the guards desk, I had a note, and this was post 9/11, so it was a little bit unnerving. Someone had just left this brown paper bag in the lobby, and nobody knew what to do with it. So we figured it out, and somebody opened it up, and it had this blue flag, and it had this note, and I wish we would have kept the note.
Mm.
But the note said that me and my friend stole this flag from Mr. and Mrs. K's house on Halloween 1980.
Their infamous Halloweens.
Their infamous Halloween. Mr. and Mrs. K would give out the best stuff at Halloween, so many kids in town would go to their house, and they said, we took this flag from their house on Halloween, and we've had it ever since, but I finally think, you know, it needs to go back to a place it belongs. And so we framed it, and we still have that. So that's another stolen flag story.
That's another flag story, yeah. The other one I got was 85 World Series with Jerry Kuhl, a Wisconsin banker. When he was a student at Wisconsin-Eau Claire, he was here for the 1985 World Series. And he and a couple of his buddies took that flag.
They took the bunting, yes.
And then they brought it back, and they gave it back.
They gave it back.
Yeah. He was very sheepish about it. He said, here I am on Wisconsin. Banker, honest banker, and I've got this flag, and it's been eating at his conscience
ever since.
It was
and
good.
He did give it back at this beautiful time in, right, Royals history, in which we were kind of able to use it again and tie it back to those moments. So
and we'd be remiss if we didn't mention one other person, Buck O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Just how incredible he was as a Royal Scout and the kind of person he was, and how instrumental he has been in preserving baseball's history as well. And you know, baseball rises with the ship that is known as Buck O'Neill.
The thing about Buck is this is another one of those things where I don't want to say I regret, but I feel I had an opportunity that I didn't take full advantage of in the fact that I was around Buck quite a bit, and
yeah.
I didn't. You know, you think about once he's gone, you can't engage with him.
That's right.
One-on-one, you can engage with him a lot because he left a lot of legacy behind him. But to speak with him, and I wish I'd have taken more advantage, mm-hmm, of talking to him. And he was a natural storyteller, obviously, and would have been around. You know, I saw him an awful lot here at the ballpark, and always a president. He's one of those. We don't run across so many people like this in our life, and it's just that they have a particular charisma to them, right?
Yes.
There's like an electricity in the room when they
you
walk
You want to
the
be
room.
Around them.
Mm-hmm. It's like you don't even know necessarily that they're in the room yet, but there's sort of a spark in the room. It's like, what? Somebody. And then you would hear his voice, which was unmistakable, mm-hmm, and he had these huge hands. If he ever shook your hand, you felt like he was engulfing your entire body. But yes, he has such an outsized role in baseball history.
Yes.
And I was fortunate enough I'd been to the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown several times before, primarily with this project. I always told myself the first time I'm going to Cooperstown is when George is inducted. But that was the first year I was working for the Royals. So I figured that was a trade-off I could make. It's like,
right,
I couldn't get away because I was actually working as a hotter than blazes that day here. We were playing the A's. But I'd been there a couple of times, especially for the working on this Royals Hall of Fame project, and they've always been the people at the Baseball Hall of Fame have always been so good to me and the Royals Hall of Fame. But I was able to go when Buck was inducted.
Yeah.
And so I was there when that happened. And to sort of bear witness to it and be part of the Kansas City delegation and the fact that I know the Royals here, we told the National Baseball Hall of Fame, whatever normally a hometown club for a Hall of Famer, whatever duties and responsibilities they have, we want to take on. We are Buck's hometown team.
Right.
And so we want to take on those responsibilities. So in Cooperstown, we were able to do that and make sure that he was celebrated in a truly Kansas City way. So yeah. It's really one of my favorite things. And then a couple of weeks later, one of my favorite things, we had done this the year before with Satchel Paige, which was another fantastic opportunity for me, is we'd brought Satchel Paige's Hall of Fame plaque from Cooperstown to Kansas City. And that doesn't happen very often. That plaque had not left the wall in Cooperstown since the day that Satchel had been inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So we were able to bring it back to Kansas City, display it here, display it at the Negro Leagues Museum, display it at his house. So that was really special. And a couple of weeks after Buck was inducted, we were able to do that too,
yeah.
is to bring him home.
Right.
And be able to share that moment. So that was really special.
Yeah. And for you, it's obvious by now. What is it about Kansas City, Kurt? I mean, I think it's almost a superfluous question now. I could tell that. I don't care who would probably try to come after you, some other Major League Baseball team. Well, hey, we'd really like to establish a Hall of Fame in our stadium or whatever. Could you come down and go to work for us or whatever? I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
I'll stay as long as the Royals have had me, because will have me, because I truly love this place. I love and when I say this place, I'm speaking both the Royals and mm-hmm. broadly Kansas City. It is, I was talking about Tulsa as my hometown, and you always have that special place for the place that you grew up. But mm-hmm. Kansas City is, that's what I talked about, the idea of, you don't have to be from Kansas City to be a Kansas Cityan. And I believe that I am, and I'm grateful for it, is that I'm a Kansas Cityan through and through. I do have it in my blood, and the fact that I have so much of my family came from Kansas City, but I'm glad to have brought my family back to Kansas City and to be able to be involved in something that you truly have love and passion for. And as you know, in probably in any business, but maybe sports has a particular hold on this, is there's a particular group of people that you get to work with. And if you're fortunate enough to be around as long as I have, you have people that you once worked with at the Royals that don't work here anymore, but you still feel they're part of your family. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm the most blessed person in this town. and it's just, there is something special about Kansas City. There's something special about the Royals and the idea that I've been able to be both of them and plan to be part of both of them for a long time to come.
Exactly right, folks. Don't worry about it. Royals will play in a different ballpark eventually. Okay, and all I will say is that the Hall of Fame is going to go along with them. So, and Kurt will have a whole new project to take care of at that point. So, Kurt, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today. And God bless you. And you're one of the two true treasures, and so is this place. And so are the Royals. I don't think people understand how important they are to the fabric of our society, and being able to help us enjoy some of our off time and wonderful ways to be able to forget about life for a while and just come out to the ballpark and have a good time. So
it's a beautiful thing.
You bet. Thank you, my
friend. Thanks for having me.
You bet, Kurt. You bet.